You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about where students have access to free and reduced-price school lunches in Wisconsin and where they don't. First, nearly two-thirds of online gamers in America say they've experienced severe harassment while playing games online, including threats of physical violence and stalking. In addition, many say they've been targeted based on things like their race, gender, faith, or sexual orientation. Those are a few of the takeaways from a new report out this month from the Anti-Defamation League, which looks at how digital spaces are being used and misused and the consequences online of hate and harassment. Daniel Kelly joins us now. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Technology and Society at the Anti-Defamation League. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Video gaming is a hugely popular form of entertainment these days, and tons of games have an online component, putting more gamers than ever in touch with people from around the country and around the world. Unfortunately, as you find in the report, that comes with some pretty significant drawbacks. Can you break down the major findings for us?
Sure. So as you said, 65% of Americans, so the survey is American adults, 18 to 45, who play multiplayer games online. And what we found was 65% of players experienced severe harassment, 74% experienced harassment of some kind. And when we talk about severe harassment, we're talking about stalking, physical threats, doxing, that kind of stuff. And we're also seeing, most troublingly, not that we want to rank these things in any particular order, but we're also seeing, we looked at the prevalence of various extremist disinformation and other kinds of conspiracy theories in online games. And we found that 23% of players were exposed to conversations about white supremacy. So specifically, we asked them, you know, have you experienced or been engaged in conversation about the superiority of whites or, and the inferiority of non-whites, which is a pretty classic white supremacist message. And we found that 23%, almost a quarter of players, were exposed to those kind of conversations, in addition to being targeted because of their identity. And this has real impact on their lives. People responded that they, you know, 5% of people responded saying that they called the police because of an incident in an online game. People are making changes to their physical safety as a result of these things. Some people are becoming less social, or it's impacting personal relationships or their school performance. So this is not ephemeral. This is having real impact on people. And the other thing that you should know, the gaming industry should take note of, is that 19% of respondents just said that they quit a game because of harassment. So it has impact on these individuals, and if that's not enough for the gaming industry to take action, it has impact on their bottom line, in the sense that people are, you know, choosing to disassociate themselves with certain communities because of harassment they experienced.
You use the term doxing, which my understanding is that is revealing someone's real name and information about them. Why is that a big deal?
Sure. So someone can take, 29% of our respondents said that they had experienced doxing, which is incredibly high. Why this is important is that people can take your personal information, whether that's your name, your birth date, your place of business, and they can take the harassment that they are, you know, that you're experiencing, and have it exist outside of the game environment or the online environment. We've heard stories of people showing up at people's places of employment, right? We've heard stories of people who their addresses are put out there, and people, there's something called swatting, where people call the police department and a SWAT team shows up at your house, right? These are the kinds of things that are, you know, in the very severe sort of category, but can be a result of doxing.
Daniel Kelly is the Associate Director of the Center for Technology and Society at the Anti-Defamation League. We're talking with him about online harassment of people who are gaming. And Daniel, if you can explain for people who might not have ever taken part in one of these online gaming platforms, how are you interacting with other people?
Sure. So there's usually kind of two different modes of interaction. One of which is a sort of scrolling game chat where people can type in messages and respond to people who are in the same game environment as them. The other is in voice chat. So many games have a sort of microphone component where you're actually able to speak and hear the voices of other people who are participating in the game. Now, like Twitter, like Facebook, there are well-trod mechanisms to flag hate speech and other kinds of harassment and that kind of behavior in text chat, like in the chat box that I mentioned. But the level of tools and ability of companies to do content moderation, which is what this is, in voice chat, is extremely rudimentary and limited. And our study found that there was an equal amount of harassment in voice chat and text chat. So the fact that there isn't content moderation in these voice chat spaces is really alarming.
Tyler on Facebook wrote, "Racism is alive and well in online gaming. Racist names are considered amusing by lowbrow gamers. You'll regularly have some guy in voice-enabled games screaming the N-word repeatedly. In shooter games, sometimes when you kill someone, they'll get so mad, they'll go off on a racist or anti-Muslim rant. It's pretty sad." Mm-hmm. Daniel, that sounds like exactly what you were talking about.
Absolutely. No, this is something that is, you know, the prevalence of this and the prevalence of it specifically being targeted against people because of their identity is something that we hear time and again in our conversations with people who are players in the struggles that the game industry, in our conversations with the game industry, that this is a very real problem, and it impacts people significantly.
Are there particular types of games that you are seeing more of this harassment happening? Is there something about the types of games that brings particular players to it, perhaps?
Sure. So, you know, there, going into the study, we kind of imagined that we would see harassment being more prevalent in, for example, online shooters, which, you know, first-person or third-person shooters, which get blamed for everything, right? But I think we looked at 15 games that were, you know, spanned the gamut from first-person, third-person shooters to more like strategy games or card games or sports games. No game had less than 50% of respondents say that they had experienced harassment. So at least 50% of people who responded saying they played a certain game experienced harassment in that game. We are seeing, you know, in the sort of top five of the games, Dota 2, which is a what they call a MOBA, a massively online battle arena, as well as Counter-Strike Global Offensive, Overwatch, Player Unknown Battlegrounds, which are all forms of shooters, and then League of Legends, which is also a MOBA as well. So we are seeing, you know, that there is the higher end is these shooters or strategy games. But again, across the board, we are seeing at least 50% of folks experiencing harassment, regardless of the game type.
It's true, though, also that a lot of people find community and make friends through mm-hmm. these platforms. So what kind of advice would you give to people who are either currently gaming or thinking of gaming to get the good out of it and at least maybe minimize the bad?
Sure. So I guess I wouldn't put the I would put the onus first on, you know, I think there are certainly things that players can do to mitigate these things. And, you know, like, but that shouldn't be the, I don't think that should be the focus of our intention. The focus of our attention should really be to make, to ensure that game companies and civil society organizations like the ADL and others are really working towards making it so that these environments, so that players aren't forced to find ways to mitigate problems that are inherent in the design, such as not having content moderation in voice chat. You know, like the ESRB is the rating system for games, right? But right now they rate games based on the content of the game itself. So does it have nudity? Does it have graphic violence, right? But there isn't any sort of rating system that takes into account the nature of an online community. And that's something that really we need to have in order for players to be able to make informed decisions about the kinds of games that they play.
And very briefly, is there a role for policymakers in this as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there are, we found overwhelmingly that, or at least the majority of players support more protections for people who are targets of cyber harassment. And so that's definitely a role where policymakers could have an influence and could make a difference.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Daniel Kelly is the Associate Director of the Center for Technology and Society at the Anti-Defamation League. He joined us to talk about the group's new report on the social interactions and experiences of online video game players and the harassment and hate that many players often experience. And you can share your experiences and your thoughts on this topic over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're a gamer, does this ring true to you? Have you been the subject of harassment, or have you seen others deal with harassment? Have you heard hate speech? Have you been exposed to these? And has it made you reconsider whether you want to continue playing these games or not? You can share your experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk about free and reduced price school lunches in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, 20 Democrats running for president are squaring off this week in another round of debates. We'll check up on that and other news in national politics in just a bit. First, the National School Lunch Program gives kids healthy, affordable school lunches that, if not for the program, their families might not be able to afford. It's been running since the 1940s, and people often think the program is used most in urban areas. But as our next guest says, in Wisconsin, there's a big need in rural areas, too. Sarah Kemp is a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Project at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She spoke with WPR host Keely Bultina about her latest piece for WisContext titled A Season of Hunger for Many Wisconsin Kids.
I want to start with our conversation about free and reduced lunches by helping us understand the program. This is administered through schools. Tell us a little bit about it.
So the free and reduced lunch program, which is called the National School Lunch Program, is a federal program that is administrated through the state agency, the Department of Public Instruction.
You mapped where children receive free and reduced lunch prices across the state. Tell us what you found.
So we looked at the free and reduced lunch program eligibility. The school district submits the eligibility information to the state. And so we looked at it across the state, and we use a classification of dividing districts between urban, suburban, town, and rural. And so we looked at the differences between those areas of the state. In general, we see more use of this program in rural areas and urban areas than we do in other parts of the state, especially in the central and southeast part of the state.
And so we're talking more the extreme city, the extreme rural areas, as opposed to smaller towns, medium-sized communities.
That's correct, yes.
And why are the child poverty rates in these areas so much different?
Well, So I'm not sure I can really address why they are. It's just we have higher child poverty in urban areas and in rural areas. Children in the cities, we currently have about 20% of children living under the poverty level. And in rural areas, in the more rural districts, it's 15%. As compared to the towns, which and the town districts are at 13%, and the suburban districts are only at 8% in terms of children living under the poverty level. So, I can't really address why that is. It's just that is what we see in a geographic pattern in the state.
When you look at those poverty rates in those areas, the poverty rates are lower than the number of kids approved for free and reduced lunches. How does that work?
So even though we see a poverty level that is lower, when we look at the federal classification of poverty. The free and reduced lunch program actually allows that number to be larger. We see a much larger eligibility for free and reduced lunch than looking directly at the poverty level of children, because it's a way in which they provide. The way the program is designed is that there is a percentage of students that are eligible based on a higher level of, so they look at the poverty level of households, and if you are 135% below that level, then you're eligible for a free lunch. And if you are anywhere between 130%, 185%, you're eligible for a reduced price lunch. So it's just a different way of classifying and providing this program to reach out to more students, more children than just those that are under the poverty level.
Sure. So it's an expanded pool of kids who may experience food insecurity.
That's right. Yep.
Sarah Kemp is a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin's Applied Population Laboratory. And we're talking about what free and reduced lunch numbers can tell us about disparities across Wisconsin. Sarah, I want to step back. Let's talk about some basics. Help us again. Who is eligible for those free and reduced price lunches in general? We just talked about the range, but what kind of kids, where are they?
So the children that all children are eligible for the program if they fall under this guideline that is provided by the federal government. So the students that are eligible for free and reduced lunch are across the state in every district, and there is also some districts that even are eligible for a community eligibility provision that allows the entire district to participate in the program. But otherwise, it's a program that if you fall under this classification of eligibility, you apply to the district that you live in, and that application then provides that program this program to you.
Yeah, and what do the numbers look like? How much is the free and reduced lunch program used in Wisconsin?
So if we go back to this, looking at it based on these classifications, these regional classifications, we have 57% of urban students participating in the program as of last year. Our next category down, highest percentage is 42%, and those are the rural districts, followed by the town districts at 40%. And then the one last group of suburban students participate the least at 24%.
Even at 24%, though, that's one in four students in our least, in areas with the least need. What do you make of that?
That's true. So that does tell you that need for the program is throughout the state, regardless of the socioeconomic status of a district. So it's a program that does reach across the state.
Do we know what the trend looks like? Are more kids needing free and reduced lunches? I mean, this program's been around since the 40s.
Correct, yeah. So the program started in 1946. We have a chart that's on the essay in WisContext, and we looked back at the turn of the century in 2000. And if we look at from 2000 going forward, it did increase each year steadily up until 2014, and we really did see a bump up in the use of the program during the Great Recession. But since 2014, the levels have, it's leveled off, and we're looking at about 44% of an eligibility rate over the last 5 years since 2014.
What does your research show could be done? Where should we be concentrating these efforts to try to alleviate poverty in Wisconsin?
Well, this is just one program that provides a resource to families and children throughout the state, and it's just very important that this particular program is the education is provided to the families to make them aware of this program, that it is available, and also to share. Many districts have many other programs they are involved in terms of farm to school, and as I mentioned, the summer program, summer food service program. So all of these programs really help provide the necessary and important nutritional food for students throughout the state.
How should we think about work against poverty? Are policymakers focusing enough on access to, in this case, school lunches?
I think so. I think there is, an awareness of how important it is, and I think it is something that is always, a part of a discussion. There's been, there's another article that's on WisConText just talking about the program in general and the history of this program and how valuable it has been. So I think it is important to many. And there's an acknowledgement of the importance of it.
Yeah. Are there other kinds of things that we could do to increase access to the National School Lunch Program?
Again, I think it just comes back to that awareness and that education of families to know that this program is out there and available to their students, and to show how easy it is to access it.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Kemp, a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She spoke with WPR host Keely Boltina about access to low-cost school lunches in Wisconsin. You can read her article over at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check in on the week's happenings in national politics, including another round of Democratic presidential debates. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new bill in Congress looks to increase funding for Great Lakes cleanup and restoration efforts. We talk with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who was one of five lawmakers to introduce the legislation. First, we're taking a look at some of the week's top news in national politics. The director of national intelligence became the latest cabinet official to resign. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is getting involved in a redistricting dispute in Michigan. And the first of this week's Democratic presidential debates was held in Detroit yesterday, with round two happening tonight. Our question for you this week, if you watched the debate last night, what did you think? Do you think Democrats should embrace ambitious ideas on health care and the environment, or dial back some of their plans? Will you be watching for anything tonight? And if you don't plan on voting for a Democrat, are you still paying attention to the field of candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post or email at ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. He's also author of the book Epidemic, Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the resignation of Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence. President Trump says he'll be leaving the job in a couple of weeks. Do we know why he's resigning?
Well, this has been a long time coming. Dan Coats is a longtime former member of the United States Senate, a former U.S. ambassador to Germany, and somebody who's I hate to say part of the establishment in Washington, but somebody who's been around Washington for a very long time. He was seen as a steady hand running the Office of the Director of the National Intelligence, and somebody who routinely spoke truth to power in the form of President Trump, especially in regards to Russian interference in the 2016 election, a topic that President Trump is quite sensitive about. There were a few occasions where it appeared that Coates even maybe undermined President Trump, threw some shade, I guess, as the kids say these days, on President Trump in standing up for the intelligence community against what the president's sort of more natural political inclinations were. And therefore, there's been a tension between his office and the White House for a very long time, almost since the day he was sworn in as the director of national intelligence. So we saw this coming. It appears that Coates has now decided that it is the appropriate time to leave. There's no hint that he was actually fired or pushed out, but, we wouldn't really have been surprised if he had been.
President Trump says he'll nominate Republican Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe for the job. Tell us what we know about him.
John Ratcliffe is the former mayor of a small town called Heath, Texas, population about 8,000. From there, he served as U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Texas under George W. Bush for the last 2 years of the Bush administration. And since 2015, he has served in Congress. So that's about two terms in Congress in what is a pretty conservative district in North Texas there. He is one of the more zealous defenders of President Trump. We saw him during the Robert Mueller's testimony a couple of weeks ago, defending President Trump, questioning the origins of the FBI investigation that became the special counsel's investigation. President Trump was reportedly thrilled about that, and afterwards nominated John Ratcliffe to be the next director of national intelligence.
We're talking with Reed Wilson right now. He is a national correspondent for The Hill. We're taking a look at some of the big news stories out of Washington this week. And Reed, let's move on to some activity on the part of former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. The National Republican Redistricting Trust, a group headed by former Governor Walker, has sued to block a citizen redistricting group in Michigan. Can you give us a little more information on that?
So back in 2018, Michigan voters passed what they called Proposition 2. It was an amendment to the state constitution. They passed it with 61% of the vote, so a pretty wide margin, that would create, basically take the role of drawing political boundaries, the decennial redistricting process, out of the hands of the state legislature and put it into the hands of a citizen-led commission. That's similar to the way that states like Arizona and California and Washington draw their political districts. And the goal, they said, was to create fairer districts that allow citizens to pick their politicians rather than politicians to pick their constituents. A provision in that bill, though, excludes certain people from serving on the commission. And that includes people who hold, positions with political parties, people who are elected officials, people who were registered lobbyists, and crucially, their family. That provision is what Scott Walker and the National Republican Redistricting Trust have sued over. They say that violates people's First and 14th Amendment rights to participate in the political process. And they're suing on behalf of a bunch of Republican voters and people who essentially fall under that exclusion. And what they want is they want the Republican legislature to continue drawing the district boundaries. The district boundaries that exist in Michigan right now, just like the boundaries in Wisconsin, have been subject to countless rounds of lawsuits between Democrats who say that they are unfairly gerrymandered and Republicans who say, well, that's the way that the U.S. Constitution is written. This is the next front in the battle over redistricting that we've really seen heat up in the last 4 or 5 years. We're going to see Democratic groups led by the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, which is headed by former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder, suing, essentially trying to get states to move towards these commissions. And we're going to see groups like Scott Walker's group fighting against the commissions, trying to keep the political drawing, boundary drawing, in the hands of state legislators, especially after the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled that, it's really not up to the courts to decide whether or not gerrymandering for political purposes is legitimate.
Let's move now to the Democratic debate, which started last night. Part two is tonight. Last night, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, generally considered the most progressive candidates in the field, were at the center of the stage. What stood out to you about the dynamic between them and the other eight candidates that were up there with them?
Yeah, they were at the center of the stage and at the center of the debate. They sort of suffered the slings and arrows from all sides. It was appropriate that they were in the middle, and their assailants were on each flank, if you will, because what we really saw was the first attempt to sort of pierce the armor that Warren and Sanders have built around this much more liberal, much more progressive vision for America, for what I think Warren might call wholesale structural change. There were a number of candidates, former Congressman John Delaney, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, some of the other, I hate to say lesser known, but people who are polling behind those two frontrunners, who questioned whether or not they were offering fairy tales, whether they were those two candidates were truly offering positions and plans that, one, would be popular with the American public, and two, are actually feasible in terms of passing through Congress that is at best going to be narrowly divided between Democrats and Republicans after the 2020 elections. We saw some candidates try to really distinguish themselves because this is really their last chance to do so. The next round of debates comes with a much higher threshold. The candidates who make it have to reach 2% in qualifying polls, which is tough. That's not easy to do. And to have raised donations from 135,000 different, 130,000 different donors from across the country, which is, again, not easy to do. So this was their last chance to really stand out. And for a candidate like Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio, or a John Delaney, or a Steve Bullock, who didn't even make the first debate because he got in the race so late. This is really their last chance to speak before literally millions of people who are tuning in, trying to make their decision, and who can now vote with their dollars or with their poll response questions on who makes it going forward. The Democratic primary is poised to be whittled down in the coming weeks and months, and they are desperately trying not to be whittled.
Well, even as it does, and obviously it is going to be whittled down from 20 to a lot less that are on the stage, let alone running, there is this emerging thread of, do we go with safer, more feasible, perhaps, plans, or do we go for the best that we can, and kind of what our ideal situation is? And as you said, former Congressman John Delaney was one of the candidates to go after Sanders and Warren. It was interesting that Sanders and Warren were almost a team kind of fighting off the moderates. Here's a listen to what Senator Warren had to say after Delaney called her policies unrealistic.
I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So, Reid, do you think this is going to be a continuing theme of the, some would say, pragmatic moderates versus the idealistic progressives, and which is going to give the Democratic Party a better shot?
It's funny. Somebody edited John Delaney's Wikipedia page after that exchange and put a place and time of death as killed by Elizabeth Warren, which was gave everybody on Twitter a decent laugh in the middle of a pretty contentious little exchange there. When I talk to voters in Iowa or New Hampshire or Nevada or some of the states that are going to be deciding on the candidates first, electability is kind of a secondary consideration at the moment, largely because the Democratic voters right now think that pretty much everybody can beat President Trump, or at least the optimistic ones who are looking around at potential candidates, think that anybody can beat President Trump. If some of these surveys that show that Trump is trailing most of the leading Democratic candidates start to turn around, then you can imagine that the Dems will look for a more electable candidate. And that's the sort of thing that Joe Biden is pitching himself as, is the candidate who is most likely to beat President Trump in the long run. One thing I think we're going to see over the coming weeks and months is a debate over what makes someone electable. And that's what Elizabeth Warren's answer right there really got to. How many voters are truly in the middle in America? How many are willing to swing between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? I think the available evidence of recent years shows that it is a vanishingly small fraction of actual voters. And therefore, most elections are no longer exercises in persuading your voters or persuading that middle to break towards you. It's more about mobilizing your own voters. Now, what's going to mobilize Democratic voters? really big structural liberal changes like Elizabeth Warren is pitching, or sort of a more moderate centrist go slow approach. In recent years, the Democratic Party has been more successful when they have chosen a candidate who can pitch themselves as an outsider trying to reform Washington, whether that's a liberal like Barack Obama or a more centrist candidate like Bill Clinton, than they have when they pitch somebody who's going on that sort of more incremental approach, like, say, a John Kerry in 2004.
We're talking right now with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, and we're taking a look at the week's news out of Washington. You can join in with your thoughts on last night's Democratic debate at 800-642-1234. If you watched the debate, which candidates stood out to you? Do you think a progressive platform is the way to victory for Democrats, or would a moderate be a better choice? If you're not likely to vote Democratic, what do you make of the field? Or is it simply too early to pay close attention? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our talk with Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill. We're looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the Democratic debates so far? Are there topics that have not been covered that you want to hear more about? Is there a topic or an issue that will determine who you will vote for? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And I want to just spend a couple more minutes on the Democratic debates. You mentioned, Reed, that, you know, there are some candidates for whom it's kind of a do or die situation right now. Did you see strong performances from any candidates who really need to give themselves a boost now to be able to stay in the race?
Well, I think in his first opportunity at the national stage, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, did something that's going to get him a little notice. I mean, I thought he was a strong contrast to some of the other lesser-known candidates on stage. He sort of flubbed his last answer on nuclear proliferation and whether or not the United States should take the use of nuclear weapons off the table. That his answer didn't make a lot of sense right there. But in the early part of the debate, I think he thought that his team thought he did a pretty strong job. You know, we'll see with these next round of polls. I am continually struck when I watch these debates, though, that there are a couple of candidates who command the stage much more effectively than others. And one of them is Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. In a couple of cases now, I've watched these debates with groups of Democrats. I watched the first debate with a group of Democrats out in Grinnell, Iowa, all unaffiliated. They were just sort of trying to figure out who they wanted to support. And at times when Buttigieg spoke, you could hear a pin drop in the place. He has a way with words, especially with talking about religion and morality, that I haven't heard from a Democratic candidate in a very long time. I think that's going to be fascinating. In talking to a bunch of those Democrats, they all sort of worry about the fact that he's only 37 years old, and he would be by far the youngest president in American history. You know, if he gets on a debate stage as, say, a vice presidential nominee, his presence and prowess is going to be something impressive to watch. He's got a poise that's far beyond his years.
And briefly, are we liable to see the candidate pool narrow significantly after this round of debates?
I think we will. It may take a few weeks, but the next round of qualifying polls and donor levels have to be met by August 28th. So that's about 4 weeks away. If those candidates figure that they just can't make those thresholds to be included in the September debates, then their money's going to dry up. They're going to realize that they'll either have to go way in debt for a super long shot candidacy or quit. And I think that decision is going to come for a lot of these people sooner rather than later.
Let's go to the phones, and Mark in Three Lakes is up. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm 60 plus years old. I saved all my life. I live a minimal life. and I want to know what the government is, you know, right now I'm, like, lost. You know, I can't get there from here because of cataracts and other things. So what is the government going to do for me?
Thanks for that call, Mark. And Reed, are we hearing anything? You know, there is this large portion of the U.S. population, the baby boomers, who are retiring at an incredibly high rate right now. Are we hearing anything about what they will do for the population?
Yeah, I think that the Democrats, especially Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have talked a lot about sort of economic justice and spreading the power of government beyond just Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Warren likes to talk about government working very well for those at the top and those who can afford the fancy lobbyists, and not very well for everybody else. That's a part of the sort of structural change that the Democratic candidates are talking about right now. I couldn't tell you specific parts of their proposals, but it has been interesting to see that the conversation that the Democratic candidates are having sounds much more like the conversation around the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, than these sort of big expansions of government programs than I think anything we've seen in the 50 years since Johnson was in office.
Let's go back to the phones, and Matthew in Wausau is with us. Hi, Matthew. Matthew? All right. Well, Reed, let's move on to a new law in California. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill this week that would require candidates for president to release 5 years of tax returns in order to get on California's ballot. Is it safe to say that this was passed with President Trump in mind?
It certainly was, and it was passed a couple years ago with President Trump in mind, too. And a couple years ago, Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the legislation. I would note that Brown himself did not release his tax returns when he ran for office back in 2010. He also a Democrat, just like Gavin Newsom. And Brown's rationalization was, look, if we start requiring tax returns, why don't we require health records next? You know, it's a slippery slope all the way down. The president's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, has already said that he's going to challenge this law in court. I find it tough to believe that this law is going to stand up to judicial scrutiny. Some other states have tried this. New Jersey looks poised to pass something like this later this year. New York tried it, and it sort of failed in the last minute. But there are a lot of Democratic states that really want to get their hands on President Trump's tax returns. I'm not entirely certain that the Supreme Court is going to allow states to add requirements for a presidential candidate to get on the ballot beyond what is already in the United States Constitution.
And lastly, Reed, you wrote this week about a handful of Republican representatives that are planning to retire before the next election, and another, Mike Conaway of Texas, just joined them today. What's going on?
Well, that's five in the last week, and this is pretty early in the season. You know, we're always used to incumbent members of Congress deciding that they're done, usually sometime after the August recess or after the Christmas holiday when they've had a time to sit down and talk to their family and sort of consider their own future. The number of Republicans who are retiring now, I think, reflects the fact that life in the minority in the House is not terribly fun. You show up, you collect your paycheck, and you provide a quorum, but you don't get a lot of input in legislation or anything like that. And a number of the members that I've talked to in the last couple of weeks are saying that they're not terribly happy doing things like defending every one of President Trump's tweets. And life in the Trump era, in this hyper-partisan era, is not terribly fun for members of Congress from either party. You know, they're yelled at in the supermarket or they're hectored at town hall meetings. So it's not a terribly fun job. And I think we're starting to see that now with some of these retirements.
Well, Reed, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to having you back.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. He joined us for a look at the week in Washington, including a new law in California that would require candidates to release their federal tax returns to get on the ballot. We also talked about the Democratic debates that started last night and are continuing this evening. Also, that former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is part of a National Republican Redistricting Trust. They are leading a case on redistricting in Michigan. Michigan, and also the resignation of Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence. You can share your thoughts on any of those issues by tweeting us at CentralTimeWPR or sending us an email. That address is ideas@WPR.org. If you're a fan of John Steinbeck's writing, or at least remember it from high school English class, you might think of weighty books like The Grapes of Wrath or East of Eden. Well, thanks to The Strand magazine, one of his short stories has been unearthed and published in English for the first time. It's called The Amiable Fleas, like the little insects, and was written in the 1950s for publication in the French newspaper Le Figaro. It was one of 17 stories he wrote for them while he lived in Paris. He wrote them in English, but they were translated into French for publication and were never published in the original language. The story that they just found is about a French chef who has gained one Michelin star and is eager for another. But the secret to his success is his feline food taster, Apollo, who indicates his approval or disapproval after tasting a dish. Without spoiling the story too much, let's just say that things don't go particularly well on the day that the food critic visits. Besides this and a previous Steinbeck story, The Strand has also published unknown works by Ernest Hemingway and Raymond Chandler. That's because The Strand's managing editor hired a researcher to comb through manuscripts at the Harry Ransom Center, which is a rare books and manuscripts collection at the University of Texas at Austin. If the story about a French chef and his cat doesn't sound like a usual Steinbeck topic, scholars of his life and his work say that he actually always valued humor. And at that particular point in life, he was a newlywed living in Paris, which was a city he loved. So why not write about a culinary cat? Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. This is Central Time.